You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Please welcome Dr. Steve Novella. Steve!
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, April 17th, 2010, and this is your host, as you just heard, Stephen Novella. And we are live from Nexus 2010. Joining me this week, as always, is our own amateur physicist, the man with the nano plan, Bob Novella. Next, we have the original Skep Chick herself, the queen of snark, and Mrs. Sid Rodriguez, Rebecca Watson. As well, we have our own wannabe comedian, the man who's always free with the non sequitur and making fun of some strange accent, Jay Novella. And joining us, as always, is the guy who is almost too nice for his own good, and also the Popeye of the SGU, guy's always making the funny quips in the background that you have to listen carefully to hear, Evan Bernstein. And we have a special guest for this SGU live show, James Randi. Now, as always, at these events, we like to remember our lost rogue, Perry DeAngelis. Most of you probably were listening to the show back when Perry was on. We still get emails, you know, on a regular basis from people who are listening back through our archives and are losing Perry for the first time. And it still is incredible to us how much he can really emotionally affect, you know, people who are listening to him, you know, over the SGU, over the podcast. And for them, the loss is still fresh, and they feel compelled to write to us. And in a little way, it touches us, but we sort of lose Perry all over again every time that happens. But it still keeps him fresh in our mind. And, of course, you know, his name comes up frequently on our show because the kind of person that he was, and you know, which touched all of us, still lives on in the show through all of us. So we take this moment to remember the great Perry DeAngelis. Evan, what is that plume of smoke behind me?
Wow. That's a heck of a plume, isn't it? That is a volcanic eruption. The one in Iceland we've all been hearing about the last several days, unless you've been in a cave somewhere, or trapped in Europe. So what we have here is a glacier in Iceland, pronounced Eyvindarlaviks. It took me a long time to...
Say that again, Evan.
Eyvindarlaviks.
Leavitz?
Leavitz.
This
is that's the name of the glacier that covers the volcano in Iceland, and it went up. It actually went up last month initially. There was an initial explosion in March, but on April 14th, it really blew its top, about 20 times more powerful than the explosion that happened in March, and it is causing some pretty big havoc over Europe. Air traffic, as far as I know today, is still shut down in just about all of Europe. It's quite an event. There's not been something this restrictive on air travel since the events of September 11, 2001.
Yeah, it's something. This is the biggest European flight shutdown ever.
Ever.
Perfect timing. Yeah. A volcano.
This volcano has erupted before in history, back in 920 A.D., 1612, and in 1821. So this is an active volcano that does bear fruit quite regularly, and we are feeling those effects right now.
So why are we talking about this volcano, Evan?
Well, we're talking about the volcano. Well, because it is big news, because it is the topic of science, and because it has affected us at the SGU in a sense.
Right. So you all know that Rebecca moved to London. For some reason, she thought it would be a good idea to live with her husband.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And all the London airports were shut down. They're still shut down. So how did you get here?
Magic.
Was it this you rode some unicorns across a rainbow or something?
I was actually just waiting for you to stop talking so I could say, I rode a unicorn.
Okay. Yeah. You're not as tall as last time. Are they not feeding you over in London?
No. I've lost a little bit of weight. And
you don't like
I'm
the bangers?
I'm not feeling very good.
No. Not into the bangers, huh?
I went blonde.
Yeah.
Sid likes blondes.
I get it.
That was a little awkward. Okay, so we actually have audio of Rebecca, so let's let Rebecca say hi.
Hi.
No, you're Faux-becca. Rebecca is.
What do you think?
Hello, everyone at Nexus. This is Rebecca Watson. I'm sorry that I couldn't be there, but there was a volcano and my plane couldn't take off, and it was exactly like in 2012, only instead of John Cusack, it was me, and instead of Yellowstone National Park, it was Iceland, and instead of billions of people dying, it was a slight inconvenience for me. So yeah, you can see how those two things relate and how this is much, much worse. So I'm so sorry I can't be there, but I hope you all have a good time, and I hope to see you all at the next live show we do.
I noticed she didn't commit to what live show that would be. Ooh. Just the next one, whatever. Next one I guess she could make it to. But for those of you who may not have noticed at this point, that sitting to my left is actually the new head of the Boston Skeptics. Right?
Yes.
Yes, Liz Gaston. Liz, welcome.
Hi.
She's wearing Rebecca's hat and coat, which she had intended to return to Rebecca today.
No, I didn't.
Oh.
I'm keeping these.
That she stole from Rebecca. So we figured that nobody would notice. You know, we brought her out wearing Rebecca's hat and coat.
And squatchy.
And squatchy, right. That was good camouflage. So how are things going up at Boston Skeptics?
They're pretty fun. It's been really cool getting to be more involved with it. And I have to say, though, I'm not really the head. I'm like part of the head group. So they have to give credit to all my friends who do a lot more work than I do. But I'm the host of Boston Skeptics in the Pub. And if you'd like some more information about that, you can just go to bostonskeptics.com. We have other events around Boston, too. Like, we have a book club. We have brunches. So, yeah, we have a lot of cool stuff going on.
Steve, Liz is also representing Sid here, so flip your name tag, please.
Hello, governor.
Sid.
Jay made her do that.
Yeah, that was Jay's fault.
I told you about him, an accent, I'm telling you. All right. Anybody in the room ever have a near-death experience? Not a lot of people know this, but Perry actually had a near-death experience. Unfortunately, he died right after that. So we never got to hear what it was.
You really went there, Steve.
It's too soon?
No, we can make it.
All right. No, Perry would love that.
There was one of the times that Perry was hospitalized, he actually did have like a lack of oxygen experience where he thought he was being abducted by aliens.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is similar, right?
Well,
not really.
It was a brain experience, so it's similar in that way. Yep. And the way he told this story was that when he first snapped back to reality was when he saw my daughter, Julia, who was like 2 at the time, or 18 months. And that he knew that she couldn't be part of some alien conspiracy to abduct him. So that brought him back to reality. Now, but near-death experiences are one of those topics that we've discussed previously. That is an experience that people have when they are getting cardiopulmonary resuscitation, their heart stops, they're unconscious, they're getting just enough oxygen to the brain to keep it from dying, but not enough to be conscious. And then when they wake up from this experience, which may be a day or two later, some people will report seeing a light or a doorway, maybe even passing through a tunnel, maybe seeing people that they know that have already died, and feeling as if they're floating outside their body, usually above their body. They often may actually even report that they can look down and see their body beneath them. And Then when the case reports get interesting, some people report actually some of the details of like which nurses were attending to them while they were getting CPR. Now, of course, this is there's almost a cottage industry of book writers and others who are promoting this as evidence for the afterlife. But skeptical neuroscientists like myself and others would point out that all these experiences are remarkably similar to what happens to the brain when it is deprived of oxygen. And in fact, we could induce all the components of that experience, floating outside one's body, for example, with either medications. Now we can do it by using transcranial magnetic stimulation to turn off parts of the brain. I've had patients who have had that experience while having a seizure. So there's a lot of evidence sort of triangulating on the fact that this is probably a brain experience, not any kind of dualistic mind separate from body experience.
Steve, I think I remember reading, they said that people in the Dark Ages actually had different experiences, like the similar experience, but like the idea that was playing in their head was different. Like today people see like a stairway or visitations from dead relatives, but back then didn't they see like more horrifying details?
Culturally relevant?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that phenomenon is more relevant to the like alien abduction hypnagogia, where in the Middle Ages people saw demons and angels, now they see aliens, right? So same exact experience, just replace the demon with an alien. So that's very culturally specific. With near-death experiences, they do sort of fit in around the edges, culturally specific experiences. So Christians have a Christian near-death experience, basically.
Steve, I must say that I had an automobile accident when I was 17 years of age in Toronto, Canada. I was struck by a car, had a spinal injury, and I woke up in the hospital having already gone down a tunnel with a light at the end of it. The typical classical experience that people relate. So I've had the experience myself, therefore I can relate very, very closely to it. It's very realistic and interesting too. I made notes.
Mm-hmm. Steve, isn't the tunnel itself a neurological phenomenon based on the structure of the brain, not something that you can filter through your culture, but something that's actually because of the way the brain is structured.
Yeah.
That's why you see what appears to be a tunnel.
So that's one of the common cross-cultural elements is the tunnel vision floating outside the body. The real hardcore neurological stuff is cross-cultural. But then, you know, seeing an angel or something more cultural gets filled in. You know, the details get sort of retrofitted into this experience, basically. So the new news item, the reason why we're talking about this, putting this in context, is a new study that was published where they essentially they looked at a series of people who had cardiac arrest and were resuscitated. They had cardiac arrest outside the hospital and then were brought in and resuscitated in the emergency room. And you know, typically about 10 to 15% of people who undergo that will have a near-death experience. The other 85% or so do not. It's not really clear why that is. And whenever you have two groups like that, you can ask questions. What's different about the two groups? And that's what they did. They looked at a host of metabolic parameters. And what they found is the only thing that correlated with having a near-death experience was increased carbon dioxide levels in the blood. Nothing else correlated with it, not the duration, not the oxygen. And one of the leading, actually their leading hypothesis going in was that it was medication, that the people who were getting narcotics and other drugs surrounding the event, that maybe they were producing the experience, because we know drugs can produce similar experiences. But that didn't correlate, whereas the CO2 very highly predicted who would go on, who had a near-death experience and who didn't. Now, this is an observational study, right? Obviously, it's not blinded in any way. It's not experimental. You can't, make people have a cardiac arrest and randomize them, So we have to be satisfied with them, right? No, we have to be satisfied with these kind of observational studies, so you never know what the cause and effect is, right? That's the thing. You don't know. We have no idea. First of all, is the correlation real or is it spurious? Needs to be replicated. If it's real, where's the arrow of cause and effect? Is the high CO2 causing the brain to have this experience for certain modules in the brain to shut down to make you feel like you're floating outside your body, for example? Or is the high CO2 just a marker of something else, which is really the thing that's causing these experiences? So this is, again, very preliminary evidence. We can't really make any conclusions from it. The major problem I have with this study, actually, those are just generic weaknesses of this kind of study. The major problem I have with it is the premise that the people who are having the experiences are having them while they're undergoing CPR, because that's when they measure the oxygen, the carbon dioxide and everything else. That's when their CO2 levels were elevated. But what if the experience that they're having is occurring an hour later or a day later while their brains are slowly recovering from the experience? Then by the time they become conscious, they conflate all those memories. They have no time sense. To them, it just happened, right? And just happened, so it must have happened while they were getting CPR. They were floating outside their body. But they could have incorporated memories from the last 2 days when they were delirious, when their brain was slowly recovering.
Why would their sense of time change? Because I think when I sleep, I have a sense of time.
Yeah, but have you ever had full general anesthesia?
Yeah.
Was there any passage of time?
I don't remember.
No. Yeah, right.
Success.
Yeah, I mean, probably a lot of people here have had the kind of general anesthesia where you're going 99, 98, 97, and then bingo, you're in the recovery room. There was no passage of time, right? I mean, if the mind were separate from the brain, I don't think that's what you would experience, right? Wouldn't you have some experience for the 2 hours or whatever? But when your brain is off, there is literally zero appreciation for the passage of time.
What about dualism?
Right.
I'm agreeing with you.
I know.
Oh, Steve, you mentioned the counting backwards thing. I remember a stint from the Honeymooners many years ago with Art Carney and Jackie Gleason, the late greats. I mean, it was just wonderful. Jackie Gleason is in the bed, and they've given him sodium pentothal, and the doctor says to him, count back from 100. And Art Carney says, why? He says, oh, because when he stops counting, we'll know that he's under the effect of the narcotic. Oh, okay. So Gleason says, oh, all right, 100, 99, 98, 4. And his head dropped to the side.
Right.
But, you know, this business also, I must recount to you, if I may, for a moment. When I was recovering from this trauma of hitting my back rather strongly in an automobile accident, I remember that I saw the tunnel with the light at the end of it, and there was a rumbling sort of a thing, and I didn't know what that was all about. And it turns out that I was on a gurney or stretcher, whatever, in the hospital being taken down a hall, and I was seeing these lights traveling above me from the ceiling, and I was trying to say, I'm alive, and so they wouldn't put me right into the box, you see. And I remember that I combined two experiences here.
I'm getting better.
The person at the end of the tunnel was the ambulance attendant who looked down and said, no, I don't think he's going to make it. And I was saying, I'm alive. But
did
I combined
you make it?
The experiences. I made it.
Okay, good.
Just in case you're wondering. Right. Very interesting what happens in the head, though. As we were talking earlier backstage, Steve and I were speaking. Tell us that story, Randy. Now, this is right along Steve's line, of course, and I shared this with him. I'm recovering, as I'm sure you know, from chemotherapy, and recovering very well. Thank you. There you go. And on my second last chemo treatment, the usual procedure was that Brandon Thorpe, my faithful assistant, there would drive me to the hospital, to the infusion ward. Oh, that's a dreadful title to see on the door. And that's where they were going to give me the bag of goodies in my pocket and whatnot to be infused for a couple of days with this dreadful poison. They poison you almost to the point of death, and then they draw you back a little bit, you see, every time. And I survived, as you see. But on my second last visit, I had Brandon drive me over to the hospital, just two blocks away from the foundation. I knew that my cell phone would not work inside the building, shielding on the walls, you see, as in this building itself. And so I would call Brandon when I came out of the infusion, and I would walk over to the parking lot. Now, Brandon was driving a rattletrap, still is, rattletrap white car, and with loose parts on it and everything. It's quite dramatic to see it moving, I can assure you. And I walked down towards the parking lot. Now, there's a media parking section there with five spaces just for the media, and you have to have a permit inside your windshield or you can't park there, you see. Well, Brandon happens to have a media pass, so he could wait for me there. So I walked down to the parking lot, and I saw his car come in, and he pulled into place in the media section, and he got out of the car, and he started towards me, and I waved at him like this, but he didn't react, and I thought, well, he just didn't notice me. He was on the cell phone, perhaps, I don't know, but as I got closer to him, I walked up to him, saw him very plainly, and then suddenly, like Photoshop, it wasn't Brandon. It was a totally different guy, taller, with black hair, totally unlike Brandon altogether. That wasn't Brandon, because at that moment, Brandon came around at the corner in another car, his mother's car in this case, his was out of order. He drove up and went into his parking space in the media, and he got out, and it was Brandon this time. But I had hallucinated completely the presence of Brandon Thorpe coming out of the car and walking towards me and not acknowledging my hand wave like this, and suddenly he came around. This is an astonishing thing, but that's what the brain will do. And as I said to Steve at the time, most people have the illusion that their sensory impression of an event, of the world around them, always represents reality. Not necessarily, folks. And it may happen to you in the difficulties of chemotherapy or some other narcotic of any kind. But with me, it has happened. Now, I'm an illusionist. I specialize in producing these illusions for people. For entertainment purposes, I add, always. The point is, I, as a magician, experienced this wonderful transformation. And I told Steve about it. So remember, it ain't always the way it looks.
Right. People always say, I saw it with my own eyes. You know, seeing is believing, but...
With my own eyes. Yeah, I like that expression. Right. Who else's eyes would they see it with?
But similar to the near-death experiences, these are all brain experiences by necessity, and there's lots of ways in which the brain can go wrong. One is, like as Randy described, it tries to sort what it thinks it's seeing into a slot of something it knows. And then the details match what you think you're seeing. And the illusion is completely convincing. Until, of course, it breaks, and then you have that moment of, you know, disorientation when, you know, something becomes something else.
And Steve, Randy's example is more of expectation. He was expecting what he expected changed how he interpreted what he saw.
All the parameters were there of the white car coming in. Yeah. Not Brandon's car, but it looked enough to like it that I was fooled by it. And the guy got out, and it was Brandon. I swear it was Brandon. Yeah, right. For the first six or eight steps that he took, and then snap, just like that.
And if you were taken away, say you left at that point, not having snapped into what it was, you would have testified in a court of law
that
was Brandon. I saw it with my own eyes, right?
Yes, and I wouldn't be lying. I would be telling them what my sensory impression of it was, and I would be wrong.
Right, very core skeptical principle.
So who can we trust?
You know, that's why
science
is objectifies information. All right, Bob, you're going to tell us why we're looking at that.
Did you guys hear about the latest breakthrough in lens technology?
This is related to that.
Researchers at Graduate Aerospace Laboratories and our buddies at Caltech, I love those guys, they created a breakthrough in lens technology recently using metamaterials to focus and amplify acoustic energy. It's a really interesting advance that they made. Now, they use metamaterials. You guys have heard of metamaterials. We've talked about this in the past a lot. Scientists have used metamaterials to influence and manipulate electromagnetic radiation. It's like an engineered structure that you really can't find in nature that does bizarre things to waves. So you've heard of they always say, oh, look, it's a Harry Potter invisibility cloak. And they're kind of getting there. They can bend X-rays around objects, and they're doing some incredible things. But that metamaterial is for electromagnetism. You could also use metamaterials to influence things like seismic waves. I saw a plan for a building. They're thinking about constructing a building, and they're putting these seismic metamaterials around the building such that when seismic waves are coming at it, it just kind of bends around the building. So that's another potential application.
Why wouldn't they just turn it, like, take that energy, turn it into heat energy or something like that?
Turn it into electricity?
Well, first, you can't predict where it's going to come from, so you build it and you wait 2 centuries for an earthquake to come.
You're saying it's not a reliable energy source?
No, not reliable.
Bob, what are the metamaterials made out of?
So for 2 minutes, you got a lot of energy, but then what are you going to do? So not a good idea.
But then you need good batteries to store it. Get us started on batteries. Yeah.
What are the materials made out of?
The size?
The metamaterials. Like, I don't even know what those are.
Well, the one I'm going to talk about, you can also use metamaterials to manipulate sound energy, and this is what these guys have used. They can basically take this energy, and when I first saw this device, it didn't make sense to me. It didn't look like a conventional metamaterial, but they actually were inspired by what you're seeing here, Newton's cradle. Everybody's seen this little toy. It's been on probably a million desks for 30 or 40 years. But, you know, you just take one ball and swing it against the other, and it's a great example of conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, friction, how pendulums work. It's a great little instructive device.
Bob, what are the metamaterials made out of?
Next picture, Steve. 411 spheres, metal spheres, stacked into an array of 21 rows, 21 balls by 21 rows. You happy now, Jay? That's
yeah, but
balls.
But you're saying metamaterial. Like, are we talking ball bearings made out of steel?
Pretty much. See, because
so
when
why
you're dealing,
are they metamaterials?
Because you're influencing and manipulating waves. So that's kind of like the hallmark of a metamaterial.
I was thinking more of like nano.
Pay attention,
stuff.
Jay. No, you're thinking of the electromagnetic metamaterials are really tiny because you're dealing with wavelengths of light. So because acoustic energy has a bigger wavelength, it's more macro scale. Okay.
So they're not nano? I'm disappointed.
No, they're not nano. Sorry, not everything I talk about has got to be nano, all right?
All right, but they're meta. At least they're not meta, if not nano. But
yeah.
All right.
Right, meta.
Meta's
all right, good.
That's good enough.
So what these guys do is they see all these spheres here. They're manipulating the pressures, the balls, the spheres against each other. Some of them are pressing hard. Some of them are not pressing so hard. So they manipulate how these balls are kind of squeezing against each other. And the result, it has three basic effects. They go to the back end of the thing and they introduce energy. I think in this case it's kind of like just a kinetic energy. They just bang the back of it in some way with some device. And because of the way the spheres are packed, three things happen. The energy propagates through, not as motion like Newton's cradle, but it propagates through as like a shock wave. So you got the shock wave going from row to row to row. And apparently, because these chains are so long, they call these rows of spheres chains. These chains are so long that the energy, it doesn't bounce back and reverberate back and forth like Newton's cradle. It exits the apparatus and focuses it at a distance. However, you know, you could focus it far away or nearby, depending on how you arrange the spheres.
Bob, is it powered, or is it just using the energy that's input into it?
Yeah, it's just using the energy and focusing it and amplifying it. It's amplifying it 100 times more than any other similar device. And somebody came up with a really interesting analogy. They said that if you could somehow modify this to accept like an audible input instead of just like a kinetic bang, they said that you could go up to it and speak a normal sentence like I'm speaking right now, and it would be able to convert that into a focused energy that could rupture your eardrum. So that's kind of one example.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, it does. I was going to ask the audience, in the world of sci-fi, what does this remind everybody of?
Muad'Dib.
So in Dune, in the...
Muad'Dib.
My name is a killing word.
In the Dune movie, not the books, but the movie, they went with the idea of using this weirding module which can take audible sound and turn it into a devastating, you know, attacks of sound energy. And it just made me reminded of that.
That thing's
real
too big to wear on your neck, though, you know?
Yeah, just kind of geeky. But one potential application, if you want real world, you know, real applications for this. Medically, they're talking about using these sound waves to fry tumors. So you could actually target a tumor underneath the skin with this potentially. And because the pressure wave is so intense, the heat is really high. So it could just fry a tumor and leave surrounding tissue unharmed. Supposedly, this is a possibility. Another option is high-resolution imaging. We've all seen ultrasounds, but with this device, you could create near photographic quality ultrasound images. So non-invasive imaging, no radiation, so it could be pretty interesting.
Can you break up gallstones with it?
You could do well. The military is going to get their toys out of this too, of course, as well, because you know, because you're focusing this sound can go through anything. It can go through water, it can go through rock, because it doesn't really do anything until it actually converges to the point. So people are talking about using this idea to melt submarines underwater as a possibility.
Bob, wait a second. So this, you put the sound energy in the back of the machine. It shoots out this super focused thing, right?
Right.
And if you said it goes through, it can go through rock or go through other materials, why doesn't it just hit the material and do its damage
because
there?
The energy isn't focused until it reaches the focal point, right, the destination. That's when it's going to have all the energy.
Oh, so you can kind of like, you can manipulate it so it could say, okay, I want this machine to focus it 20
exactly.
feet deep.
So the way you arrange those spheres will determine how far away it is. And so the military could potentially use this. Also, they could use it for subterranean caves. You get Bin Laden in the cave, and conventional weapons can't affect, because of where he is, if conventional weapons don't work, this thing could potentially just do some devastating
damage. Well, as long as we could use it to kill people, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Bob.
What?
Read Kill, it. Cure, doesn't matter.
All right, Bob's new technology disclaimer. I am legally obligated to say this new technology is under development. It may take years and years to be perfected. On the other hand, you will likely never hear about this again. Please use as directed, batteries not included. Okay, that's it. I'm done.
That's from the legal department.
I must say, the fiend that I am, I would like to get one of those ball bearings out of there and secretly substitute a magnetized one. That would mess the whole thing up. The wave function would be broken completely. The pattern
It'd
would
blow
be
up.
Destroyed.
It'd probably just blow up. That'd be cool.
You're such a rascal, Randy.
Yes, I am a rascal. There's no question.
Jay, what am I looking at here? What is that?
That is a barcode scanner that can... it's actually got an incredibly dangerous label on it. It says, can kill, can
it looks like a dangerous weapon.
Around.
Yeah, if you hit someone with it, maybe.
This is a stupid little story that's going around the internet right now. There was a 12-year-old girl that went into some type of store with her grandmother. I guess one of the people that works there kind of shot the thing at the girl. And later on, they immediately get attorneys. And later on, they filed a lawsuit that said that she got burned by the scanner and it gave her Tourette's. So just a little bit of information about these types of scanners. They have LED lights in them. There's I'm not an expert on this. I'm doing research on the web. But from what I read, there's three different levels of LED light. 1, 2, and 3. And basically 1 and 2 predominate the use in these types of devices, and they can't really do any damage. Even if you did look at them, they wouldn't do any long-term damage. The third level light could, if you overexposed yourself to it, so like a quick flash like that wouldn't do anything. Even maybe for a few minutes, it wouldn't do anything. You'd have to really try to hurt yourself. So the chances of this girl actually getting injured by a quick scan like that or whatever, even a laser light from what we recently found out can't do that much damage unless you held it in your eye with it on for 5 minutes or something, and then it could do some damage. So a quick flash of these LED lights really couldn't do anything. I'm going to let Steve talk about Tourette's, but the baseline here is that people are just taking advantage of this. We're so happy in this country, number one. Number two, there's no way this device burned her or caused her actual Tourette's.
Well, yeah, in this particular story, the girl had diagnoses preceding her exposure to the scanner. And, the plausibility of a neurological disorder like Tourette syndrome, that's where you have basically a compulsive disorder. It usually goes hand in hand with obsessive compulsive disorder, right? So you have obsessions, things that you can't stop thinking about, and then also compulsions like hand washing or checking behavior. And that goes hand in hand with Tourette syndrome, which is kind of like a motor compulsion. It's a tic. You have a building within you, the desire to do something, to clear your throat, to shrug your shoulders, to do some kind of tic. And it can only be relieved by doing the tic. So you can voluntarily control it, but only for a short period of time because the need to do that movement becomes overwhelming.
And it's, always, it's often a verbal thing, too.
It could be verbal, clearing is common. Sometimes, I think what the lay perception is that it's swearing, but that's only one type of tic. The compulsion to do something that's socially unacceptable, is basically what it is.
Is it genetic? Because I did read that part of it could be from environmental...
It's one of those things where it's genetically predisposed, but it has to interact with environmental factors. So we haven't really narrowed down on the exact cause of it because it's complicated.
So let's say that the little girl got shot in the eye with this or something, and she was horrified, say, of these types of scanners. Could that have emotionally been enough to push her over the edge?
No. No, that's not going to cause Tourette's. It wouldn't even really exacerbate it. Certainly stress will lower someone's ability to deal with it, and the tics may become more prominent when they're under stress. And maybe if she was afraid of the scanner and she was stressed out because of it, that might have made her momentarily the symptoms worse. It wouldn't have actually worsened the underlying disorder itself, just made the symptoms temporarily worse. That's the worst possible thing that could happen, but that's just from her being... unreasonably afraid of the scanner. But what the amazing thing of this story is that lawyers took up the case. That's the thing that I have a hard time. Now, I'm not going to bash lawyers because, I actually work with a lot of attorneys, and my experience is that most of them are quite reasonable, and they actually, you have to get an expert to say that, yes, A caused B, right? And so these lawyers should not be going forward with this case unless they found some expert somewhere who's willing to testify in court that scanner caused the girl's Tourette syndrome. I'd like to talk to that guy. And they usually try to find people who are going to stand up to cross-examination. You know, you can't get an expert, you know, whose credentials and opinions are going to collapse under, you know, even a Mickey Mouse cross-examination. So in most cases, in fact, most cases that I review never go to trial because there's no case. An expert says, I'm sorry, but there's no case here. I mean, obviously, if this came over my desk, I would say, no, this is not a legitimate cause and effect. You cannot go forward with this. My opinion is the scanner did not cause the Tourette's, and you know, the evidence shows it wouldn't cause any burns. So it's a combination of a lawyer and an expert willing to come together to proceed with this in order to for this kind of ridiculous case to go forward. Again, this is all, I always have to say this, assuming that the reporting that we're getting is legitimate, because there's always that layer of journalism in there, and we get burned on this all the time, that really the real story is different, but the journalist pulled out something ridiculous. And because this is a personal case, I mean, there's no way, you know, there's confidentiality involved here. There's no way I can really do fact-checking on this. So, caveat, if what they're reporting is true, it's a ridiculous case. But I wouldn't be surprised if the real story is actually vastly different.
Where are we with the case, though?
It started Monday of last week.
Yeah, so which means it'll be a couple of years probably for it
Steve, our audience might be interested to know just how peculiar this Tourette syndrome is. The first time I came, I had heard about it. The first time I came upon it in the flesh, so to speak, I was standing on a waiting platform for the Underground in London. In the middle of the day, there was hardly anyone around, just a police officer walking up and down doing his rounds. And there was a very well-dressed businessman, an English fellow with the furled umbrella, the whole thing. And he was standing at the edge and looking for his train coming. And he was clearing his throat several times. And then he came up with this most surprising thing. Son of a bitch! and then he dropped his head again. And he looked around, and he saw me looking astonished, and he came over to me and said, sir, did I say something inappropriate? He didn't know.
Yeah. Wow.
His mind shuts off for that moment, and he came up with this sort of thing, and he said, oh, I must apologize. He said, I have Tourette's syndrome. And he said, please forgive me. Now, in a very calm and logical voice like this,
right.
And while he was talking to me, he went, very, very quickly, like this, and he said, did I do it again? Oh, I'm very, very sorry. He said, I should go home now. And he walked for the stairs, and he went up the stairs, and I believe he left the Underground because he was having a bout of this sort of thing. But it's involuntary, and it has then this amnesic quality that
they
forget
about. Well,
I think
they just don't pay attention to it. It's just part of the background. You know, it's like you're not aware of every little thing you're doing either.
Like clearing your throat.
Yeah, clearing, scratching your elbow or something. We kind of do all these things subconsciously. So there is no amnesia technically associated with it. It's just probably he just wasn't paying attention. Also, he may have been using that and exaggerating the degree to which he was not aware of it as a way of dealing with the social embarrassment. And that's the biggest part of the Tourette's, is that it's just, it doesn't really hurt them, but it can be socially devastating, right? That's the
I would have loved to meet Tourette. That would be an experience, wouldn't it?
Steve, can they fire you if you have Tourette's?
Oh, no. Well, not. I'm sure that's covered by the American with Disabilities Act. I mean,
so I could do this at work.
Hey.
Because I have a lot to say to my boss.
You can get away with a lot of commentary and be forgiven for it and paid for it.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
And then I won't remember any of it.
Temporary Tourette's, right?
Right, temporary.
Cured next
situational
week.
Situational Tourette's, we call it. Yeah. Simon Singh. The man who was sued by the British Chiropractic Association. This slide is just up here, just in case anyone in the audience doesn't know. The BCA dropped their libel case against Simon Singh, who has now essentially won the case.
Yes. And Simon also stands to be able to collect his expenses, considerable expenses, £100,000 or so that he spent on defense of this case. He stands a good chance of collecting that under English law. And that's another reason for celebration, I would say.
I wonder if he can get some punitive reward as well, because he spent the last year of his life doing nothing but having to defend himself
against
this.
No, the answer, I believe, is no.
So, and he will be at TAM in Las Vegas coming up very shortly.
Ooh, awesome.
So if you haven't registered, go there just to hear Simon Singh speak.
So the numbers that I've heard are he spent £200,000 out of pocket, which I understand is real money. It's not dollars, but I think it's like $400,000. And he stands to recuperate about £180,000 of that, all but about £20,000. And yes, recuperate. And but the 2 years of lost work essentially is lost. He does not get that back. Right.
Yes. And he got great support from the skeptical community all over the world. Very, very vociferous comments on it. We supported him, and he certainly deserved it.
Yeah.
Randy, how did when Uri Geller sued you? Okay, so how long did that take to settle, and how many years of your life were essentially lost?
It's Uri Geller, not Uri Geller. Please.
Whatever.
Okay, don't blame the Russians for him. No, they can be blamed for a lot of things, but not for Uri Geller. Now, it cost me most of my MacArthur grant, which was about $270,000, $272,000 to be exact, $1,000 over the years. It cost me to defend myself against Geller, but it cost him nothing because he did it on a contingency basis, convinced his lawyers that they would all share in millions of dollars that James Randi has. And by the way, it's interesting that every time that he sues me, and I guess sues most people, he uses a different legal firm because he either doesn't pay his bills or they suddenly realize that he was fibbing to them when he said that I had so much money that they could sue me for. So, yes, it cost me years of my life, literally, to defend myself.
Anybody know what that is?
That's a confectionery that you can buy out in the lobby here.
It's meta material.
Is it an organelle?
It's an organelle. It's a mitochondria. Mitochondria are the little energy factories inside every cell, and they essentially make energy, ATP, out of oxygen and sugar and the byproducts of sugar, actually. They're the ones to make all your energy. They are organelles that probably evolved symbiotically with the first eukaryotes, in that it's like a bacteria-like organism that combined with, you know, early cells. And part of the reason we believe that is that they have their own DNA. And the DNA code for mitochondrial DNA is just a little bit different than the DNA code for everything else. They probably branched off from the rest of life that we know of on this planet, you know, before everything else that we know. I mean, it's really, really archaic. The reason why we're talking about the mitochondria is because in the UK, some doctors are trying to develop a treatment for a mitochondrial disorder. Now, there are a set of genetic disorders that are the mitochondrial myopathies, actually part of my subspecialty, that you inherit only from the mother, because mothers pass on mitochondria to their children through their eggs, but the sperm has very few, if any, mitochondria. So you get almost no mitochondria from your father and all your mitochondria from your mother. So that's convenient for geneticists, because we can follow just the maternal line through mitochondrial analysis. Now, for mitochondrial diseases, where most of the proteins and everything that make up a mitochondria are actually in the mitochondria itself, its own DNA, but some of them come from nuclear DNA, the cell's regular DNA. But for those that come from the mitochondria itself, for mutations that cause really serious diseases with weakness and, you know, deafness, blindness, seizures, strokes, really serious neurological disorders, there is the potential for essentially curing or preventing these disorders from occurring by using a cloning type of technique. So imagine if you take an in vitro fertilization, you know, the egg from a woman, the sperm from a man, you fertilize it in the petri dish, now you have a fertilized egg, then you use a cloning technique, you take the nucleus out of that fertilized egg, and you transplant it into another egg where you've taken out the nucleus. So that's essentially what cloning is. Now what you have are the DNA from the mother and the father and the mitochondrial DNA from the other egg donor. So the child would literally have three parents, right? Two nuclear DNA parents and one mitochondrial DNA mother. That is a way of essentially preventing 100% any mitochondrial genetic disease. Makes a lot of sense. And you don't have to futz around with the nuclear DNA itself. So it's not really genetic engineering, right? You're not inserting genes or taking out genes. You're not altering the nuclear DNA at all. You're just sort of putting it into a cell with good mitochondria, so you don't get the cell with the bad mitochondria.
So just to clarify, it's not like the child will have an equal mix of all three parents as far as looks and everything. It's just like inserting this stuff into a cell.
Genetically, in terms of what the kid looks like, it would look like the two parents that donated the sperm and the egg would not look at all like the woman who donated the egg with the mitochondria. All she's contributing really is the mitochondria. I mean, it's also all the other stuff in the cell as well, but that's the cytoplasm and everything. But that's negligible. The real thing is the mitochondrial DNA. So it's interesting. It's neat. It's a way to have three parents without really doing genetic engineering, and it would treat a really horrible suite of diseases. However, in the UK, where this research is being done, it's illegal. It's illegal to do anything resembling human cloning, and this is kind of skirting with the edge because you're not really doing a clone, and you're not doing any kind of genetic engineering. You're just sort of swapping out the mitochondria. So this has now come up in the UK as a controversial case, and it'd be very interesting to see what happens with it, because in my opinion, this is a very effective cure for a horrible set of diseases, and I personally don't see any ethical problems with doing this. I really don't even think this is should be considered cloning or genetic engineering. It's really just mitochondrial therapy, if you want to call it something else. But it's causing a row now in the UK, and we have to wait and see how this pans out as far as the laws are concerned. But right now, they're saying it's against the existing statutes in the UK against human reproductive cloning, which is what
Steve,
they're calling it.
Is it obvious, though, to parents that my kid is going to have mitochondrial problems, but they have kids anyway, or is it accidental, like, oh, wow, I didn't anticipate this? Will it prevent the accidental births that people didn't even know?
It's a good question. I mean, it's passed down through the maternal line,
right.
And most of them are dominant. So if your mother is a carrier, if your mother has the disease, she will pass it down to all of her kids, right? Because she contributes almost all the mitochondria to every child. But sometimes the diseases don't really have their clinical onset until the 20s or later. So you may have kids before you get diagnosed.
Okay.
When would they have to do this procedure? At what point?
Well, it's part of in vitro fertilization.
Okay.
So you would undergo in vitro fertilization with this extra added step in, and you need to get a third donor to do it. Yeah. So very interesting technology, but it's getting embroiled in the old ethics dilemma. So this is a quick one. This is just a funny item. Have you guys heard of the?
Fun.
Oh yeah. Croatian girl who was in a coma for a few days, and when she awoke from the coma, she was speaking fluent German. Have you guys heard this story?
Jawohl.
Jawohl, mein Gott. Right.
Bestimmt.
Jay.
Come on, so she wakes up and she's speaking in a German accent?
No.
Speaking German?
No. Fluent German.
All right, let's clarify a few obvious things here. What language did she speak as a child?
Croatian.
Okay, how close is Croatia to Germany?
Well, it's not German.
All right, just not a German language. Not Germanic in any way.
I don't know if it's Germanic, but it doesn't matter. It's not fluent German.
She has never been instructed of German in any way.
Well, now you're getting detailed
point.
Now. So it turns out, that when you actually read the details of the case, that she was studying German.
Oh, come on, really?
Really.
What?
So she, in fact, could speak it quite well before the coma.
And this is news? Why?
So the news is that she woke up and spoke in the other language she knows.
Right. Right.
We had a perfectly good myth going there, and you destroyed it completely.
It's a miracle.
But apparently, according to her mother, she speaks German better after the coma than before.
Well, there you go.
According to the mother, yeah.
Right, there we go. That was a news story. Okay, so it's time now for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
All right. So at our live events, what we're going to do is I'm going to read all three items. You can see them up there, but I will read all three items. Then we will survey the audience through applause to see which ones you guys think are which one is the fiction Then we'll get some advice from our panel of skeptical experts, and we'll see how much influence it had on you, and then I'll do the reveal. So here we go. Item number one, researchers find that drugs like morphine and heroin may protect the brain from HIV-associated dementia. Item number two, a new study finds that late-night video game playing significantly delays sleep onset in teenagers. And item number three, physicists create a true random number generator exploiting quantum entanglement as the source of randomness. Applaud for the one that you think is the fiction. How many people in the audience think the HIV-associated dementia one is the fiction? How many think that video games delay sleep onset is the fiction? And how many think that the random number generator using quantum entanglement is the fiction? All right. So it sounded like three, then one, then two, I think is my interpretation of that. So I guess we'll start with you, Bob, and then we'll work our way down. You want to help these guys out a little bit?
Start with Randy. All right. I can see number one kind of makes sense to me. I can see morphine and heroin changing the brain in such a way that it could protect you. I wasn't even aware of HIV-associated dementia in the first place, so that's kind of interesting. It kind of makes sense. It doesn't really surprise me. Late night video game, delaying sleep onset. Isn't that obvious? I mean, you're playing.
So to clarify.
Oh, please.
This is not that people are not going to sleep because they're playing video games. It means that when they go to sleep, it takes them longer to fall asleep.
Right.
The sleep onset is a technical term for how long it takes you from the time that you lay down and try to go to sleep to the time you actually are asleep.
Right. Oh, I got that. Well, you know, when you kill aliens for 3 hours, I could see how you're all hyped up and it takes a while to get settled down, so that kind of still makes sense to me. The third one, I have always read that a true random number generator is, I think the word used was impossible. That's kind of making me lean towards that one. But on the other hand, I could see how quantum entanglement can be used as a source of randomness as well, because people try to use entanglement to say that, oh, we're going to communicate over millions of light years potentially using entanglement, and you can't because it's essentially random events. You can't encode a signal in random events. So that's random. But I'm still going to go with what I've read in the past saying that a true random number generator is true, right? Is impossible. I just want to go with that.
Okay, Fobeca.
Well, it seems like video games are always getting a bad rap for everything, so I'm just going to get this over with as quickly as possible. That one sounds pretty obvious, so I'm going to go with that as the fiction because Steve is Steeble.
Did you say Steve is Steeble?
The Rebecca method. Jay?
Item number one, it's the one about the heroin and morphine delaying or protecting the brain from HIV. I mean, from associated dementia. Yeah, I'd never heard of it, and I don't know enough about it to comment. Other than it seems like a lot of patients that are suffering from late stages of HIV would be on those drugs. And there's probably enough people doing it where they had some type of study involved. The video game playing, absolutely. I mean, I've heard. From many doctors, including my own, and read many times that, you know, you play video games late or even watching TV late or anything that is stimulating will make it takes longer for you to fall asleep, right? So you're increasing your brain activity from watching those things and hearing things. So I definitely agree on that. Real quick, though, who here plays Modern Warfare 2 on Xbox? What's up, my brothers? Physicists create a true random number generator. Steve, how can this possibly be true? A true random number generator, meaning 1 to infinity. Do I have to even go on? I can't. How? How can we generate an infinite number?
No.
Wrong.
Bob, you want to help him out a little bit?
Huh?
Want to help him out with that a little bit?
What? Go ahead.
It's not going to create an infinite number. It's going to create numbers with no pattern that you could divine.
It's not a random number then, because it's excluding those super, super high numbers.
No.
Right?
I don't think you're getting it, Jay.
Are you saying a random number generator between 1 and 10?
Sure.
Or Jay, it could just be a 1 and 0. Just a random one. It could be binary.
Right.
It doesn't have to be.
You could set the range.
Well, that's not written there, so now you're changing it.
You can set the range. So that's
so,
not
okay. So we've officially changed the parameter in item number three. So I'll start over. Item number one. It's three. Come on.
Okay. It's the random number generator.
Right.
All right, Evan.
Like my colleagues, I had no idea HIV associated dementia existed. No clue. I think that one is science. I'm caught between the video games and the random number generator, which in a way are kind of associated, I think. Well, I'm a bad example because I fall asleep very well. I'm a good sleeper, and I can fall asleep pretty much. I can think myself, and 10 seconds later, I'm asleep. So I don't think I'm a good indicator, or I can't use my own personal experience to help make that assumption.
It's anecdotal anyway.
Yeah, way too anecdotal. But this true random number generator thing is very interesting because I really hadn't heard about that either. I wasn't aware that you can't, that computers could not simulate that or come up with that. So I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around that one. I'm forced to choose. The random number generator one is fiction.
Okay, Randy?
Well, with number one, I think that people who involve themselves a lot in morphine and heroin may not care about the dementia. So maybe it's just that they don't care. They experience and they say, the same old thing, you know. But number three bothers me because it says a true random number generator. Within what limits? Now, true, that covers the whole spectrum and everything, so it's impossible to do it.
Thank you.
There's no question of it.
That was Jay's point. Right?
On the other hand, for practical purposes, several degrees of randomization certainly will give you something that's practical, that can be used, and such, but true random number generator damns the whole thing right there, because I think theoretically that is impossible, but not practically. I'm going to say that the item number two, I don't care about at all. I just
the video games.
Randy, you don't play Modern Warfare 2.
But I think that item number three is not true.
The random number generator. Okay.
Yes.
So that seems to be pretty in line with what the audience already thought. But let's quickly poll you again. Who thinks that HIV-associated dementia is the fiction? Video games delaying sleep onset? And random number generator? All right. So it did push you all a little bit in the direction of the random number generator. We'll take these in order. We'll start with number one. Researchers find that drugs like morphine and heroin may protect the brain from HIV-associated dementia. That one is science.
50-50 now.
And actually, the researchers had the opposite hypothesis. They were concerned, a lot of people who do have HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, one population are heroin abusers. So they do, abuse heroin. And also, many may be using morphine therapeutically. So there are a lot of people who have HIV, especially late stage, who actually are being exposed to morphine and heroin. They thought that it actually might be positively correlated with HIV dementia and might be contributing cause of it, and they found the opposite, that it had a very unexpected protective effect. So therefore, now they're careful to point out, they're not recommending that people start abusing heroin in order to protect themselves from HIV dementia. But what they said is that if they could find out which receptors these opiates are binding to, that could lead to drug development for a drug that could then protect against HIV-associated dementia without the unwanted side effects of morphine and heroin. Maybe not so unwanted. Right, mostly unwanted. So, yeah, there is an HIV-associated dementia. Some percentage, about 10 to 15% of patients with late HIV will start to have progressive neuronal damage and will have a fairly significant dementia. Right now, the only treatment for that is to just increase their antiretroviral drugs, the drugs they're probably already taking to treat the HIV, to keep their titers really low. But it's not really much. It's not a directed treatment. It's not really that effective. It's just something to do. All right, let's go on to item number two. A new study finds that late-night video game playing significantly delays sleep onset in teenagers. I believe that Liz was the only one who thought that this one was fiction on the panel, and a minority of people in the audience also thought this one was the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
I
100%.
Unbelievable. Yay, Liz.
I'm so happy right now.
Curse you, Rebecca.
True number generator. Awesome.
Hold on.
All right, I'll wait.
Careful. Slow down, bud.
Also,
this is bullshit.
You know, that's what the researcher said. So this is also went contrary to the working hypothesis of the researchers. Now, prior studies have shown that there is a correlation between sleep deprivation and video game playing. For obvious reasons, what previous studies have shown is that people underestimate the amount of time they spend playing video games. They underestimate the amount of sleep that they sacrifice in order to keep playing their video games and the degree of their sleep deprivation, especially teenagers. So there's a high degree of sleep deprivation and not really a lot of awareness of it among video game players. And they also, if you separate out video game addicts, which are defined as more than 7 hours a week...
7 hours?
Yeah.
It doesn't take, I could hit that in one day.
Right.
I mean, addict. Steve.
Yeah.
You don't understand. They killed Charlie! You know, like. You guys know what I'm talking about.
Two of them do.
Yeah. We'll admit to, yeah. So they say, okay, well, let's see, maybe there's another effect. Maybe it's just not that people are going to bed later because they're playing video games. Maybe, as Bob and others, you know, pointed out, that it's activating. It's not a good thing to be doing. You have to come down from your first-person shooter high right before you go to sleep. And it turns out that there was only a slight difference. There was no significant difference between sleep onset in teenagers from playing video games versus, you know, not playing video games. So that's not the problem. The problem is you're staying up till 2 in the morning playing video games, right? So that was a little bit of a surprise and very interesting, which made it a perfect science or fiction. Now, item number 3. Physicists create a true random number generator exploiting quantum entanglement as the source of randomness. Now, a true random number generator has a very specific definition. It's, you know, the ability to generate a truly statistically random sequence of digits. It doesn't have to be, obviously, any number from 0 to infinity. And, in fact, in this case, it was a binary system. It was just a 0 or a 1. Now, Bob, it's impossible to have a classical system that's a true random number generator.
So I'm right. I was right.
Classical system, right. It's only theoretically possible to have a true random number generator from a quantum system. That's I think, what you were remembering.
Well, all right, explain all that.
So
classic is the macro world, but, you know, the quantum is tiny, tiny.
More or less. Beyond nano, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you can have only pseudo-random numbers from a classical system, because in a classical system, theoretically, you could actually predict the outcome of any physical system if you know enough information about the starting point. But with quantum systems, at the quantum level itself, it is truly random. It's the physics of the universe is random at that level, right? You cannot predict what the outcome is going to be, no matter how much you know about initial conditions.
So wait. So when you're saying on the quantum level, there is no way ever that we'd be able to predict anything.
Right. There are certain quantum properties. Remember Einstein's quip, God does not play dice with the universe. This is the dice, right? The dice is the random number generator within the quantum systems. You know, where's the electron going to be at any point in
so
time?
So you're saying empirically the information does not exist.
Yeah, as far as we know, as physicists know experimentally, you cannot predict the quantum state of a system until it makes a choice and
right, and actually through superposition it's actually both zero and one, interacting with the environment. Decoherence is what actually somehow one is picked, and that's what's random. So that's kind of what they're tapping into. That's awesome.
You know, in modern warfare
that's
too.
That's when you said you're wrong, Bob.
You can pick that's one of an array of weapons. It's good stuff, man.
Let's call it the collapse of the wave function.
So it's basically random whether or not you're right.
Yes, it's truly random.
No, you're right.
No.
Number 3, it's random whether or not this is actually...
No, it's correct. So this is what the researchers did. They were able to create a quantum entanglement that would, when it did collapse, it would give off a photon, and then they were able to use the information in that. I guess they didn't go into that much detail, but there's some aspect of the photon that was able to generate randomly with proven statistical randomness, either a 0 or a 1. and they were able to use that, therefore, as a random number generator that met all the criteria, both physically and also statistically, of a true random number generator. I didn't want to say it was the first one because I couldn't prove that to myself by digging into this, and it's theoretically not the first one, so it's just one. I didn't say it was the first one.
I wonder how many trials I had to do to determine true randomness.
It took months to do this study. It's a really slow random number generator because they have to create the entanglement and then let the wave function collapse and measure it, and it took them a really long time. So the bits were trickling in very slowly over time. Wouldn't really be functionally useful for like a 256-bit security key, but that's the ultimate goal with this, right? You want to be able to generate a truly random key for security reasons. The problem with the pseudo-random number, so you know, if on your desktop, any program on your PC or Mac that requires some kind of random numbers, those are fake random numbers, right? They use some kind of method to simulate random numbers. The most common black box method of generating fake random numbers is that they have a statistically random sequence of numbers, but they're already memorized in the computer.
Pre-programmed.
It's pre-programmed. They're pre-programmed random numbers. It's fake. Of course, you can't tell if all you're doing is getting the output because it meets statistical criteria for randomness. But you may not realize that some guy somewhere knows all your random numbers, right? So it's not really useful for security purposes. You need some way of generating what they call private randomness. You need private random numbers, not just
all right,
statistically
Steve,
random
Steve,
numbers.
You got us.
Yeah, it did.
You won. Most of us chose wrongly.
Thank
We're good.
You.
We got the random number thing. Let's go.
All right.
Steve, I'm really glad this went well for me because before science or fiction, I was getting the quantum jitters.
You were getting the quantum jitters? Yeah.
Yes.
No one understood that, did they?
Yeah. Did you collapse, though? Did your wave function collapse?
Steve, quick question. What was entangled?
Actually, there were photons that they entangled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to call Chip Denman, the official statistician for the JREF, and I'm going to ask him this question about number three there. What are the chances of that?
100% apparently, because they did it.
So, Steve, when you do the year-end review and you do the stats for science fiction, can you tell everyone that I got
Liz,
100% of my...
Let me tell you a little anecdote, if I may. Of course I may. one audience, I used to do a mentalism trick, and I still do it occasionally, for my audiences when I lecture on parapsychology and whatnot. My specialty, I would do a little mentalism trick. And I asked a lady, now what I do is I take a ping pong ball, turn my back to the audience, throw it over my shoulder, and the nearest person who catches it, that's always a laugh too, because it always hits the floor, and they have to search for it. The person who retrieves the ping pong ball is the person I choose, or they can hand it off to somebody else if they don't choose to be the volunteer. So a lady stood up looking very nervous, and I said, ma'am, I would like you to give me, please, a three-digit random number, any old three-digit number whatsoever. And she looked a little fuddled, and she said, 1, 2, 3. And the audience laughed, and as you might see, you laughed too, you see. Thank you very much. And she reacts very well to cues, you notice. I said, no, they're just a random number, like take an old telephone number of yours and mix up three of the digits or something. She said, 3, 2, 1. And of course, the audience laughed louder at that point, as you did. And I looked at her and I said, wait a minute. I said, ladies and gentlemen, this lady is perfectly correct. Well, what is your problem, do you think, ma'am? She says, but I don't know any random numbers. And I said, exactly, you don't know any random numbers. Nobody knows any random numbers. But that was a lesson to me. The lady was absolutely right. A little more confused than she might have been, but she was absolutely right. No one knows any random numbers.
Right. Because we're all biased. If you try to make a random number, it will not be statistically
11.
Random.
11. There you
11.
Go.
11. 11.
Close. Very close.
All right, we have about 15 minutes for questions.
Okay.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay.
Hi. I just wanted to start off by saying how disappointed I am in you guys. During the metamaterials section, no one made a ball joke.
Rebecca's in Europe.
In case
you
didn't notice.
You guys need to pick up the slack. Come on.
That was low hanging fruit.
Yeah. Well, but come on.
Satisfied?
Yeah. Well, But my, I actually want to make a ask a question. I'm new to the medical field, and I'm actually doing stuff with mitochondrial DNA. And the mitochondrial swap you're talking about, I know that our nuclear DNA codes for proteins that the mitochondria needs. Basically, they've shoved some of that work off on us, and I'm actually developing a sequence capture array to do some genetic sequencing on those to diagnose these diseases. And I'm wondering, because you're a lot better at this than I am, if they did this, this nuclear swap, wouldn't those diseases still be a problem, the ones that arise from nuclear mitochondrial
Yes.
DNA?
So if you have a mitochondrial disease that results from nuclear DNA, that would be a problem. That would not be solved by this. This would only solve problems with mitochondrial DNA. But most of the bad, like Leber's optic atrophy and Milos and Murph, those are like the ones with epilepsy and strokes, those are mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. So it would work for those.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi. First of all, I gotta say I love Modern Warfare 2. Second of all, Steve, 7 hours, what the hell? Really?
Yeah, he doesn't get it, dude. He doesn't know. I mean,
that's not my definition.
All right, my actual question is, lately I've been thinking about I'm a teenager, but how people my age really don't, either they don't care or they don't know about most of the things that, a lot of us talk about and think about. And I have my own, theories and reasons why I think this is, but I wanted to hear you guys' take on it.
Why teenagers are not into skepticism? Is that your question?
No, why they don't they're not really serious, why everybody hates chemistry class in my school.
These kids today. Don't get me started.
No.
I mean, Plato was saying that over 2,000 years ago. I think it's just part of the human condition, to be honest with you. I don't think it's any different.
Completely agree with that. I agree. Yeah, sure. A lot of older generations are going to look on younger generations as having an attitude problem and everything. I remember I had an attitude problem. I think a lot of people here have had the discussion of how education is going down. It does seem like the parents getting involved to the degree that they used to isn't the same.
Well, parents are overly involved. They have the helicopter parents who are completely obsessively involved with their kids. It also depends on socioeconomic status. I mean, it's a very complicated issue. I don't think there's any simple answer parents are neglectful or culture is going down the tubes. I think any of those pat, simplistic answers are just really not helpful.
We
and
are
not describing
wait a second.
What's going
we
on.
Are teaching to the lowest common denominator. Right?
Well, I certainly think we need a lot of education reform. Yeah, that's one thing I would absolutely agree with.
Plus, discipline in school has dramatically changed in the last 50 years.
There's a lot of discipline in my classroom.
Of course, that's your anecdote, though. But overall,
but I think statistically that those kind of problems peaked in the early 90s. I don't think it's crime is down. I mean, not everything is getting worse.
Steve.
I think that's just a that's a confirmation bias.
What about from a purely physiological explanation in terms of brain development? Isn't there still
teenagers? Teenagers have different functioning brains than adults.
Yeah.
Their brains function differently than adults. The research is steadily...
If at all.
Yeah. So they're not fully matured. The brain does not fully mature until you're in your 20s. So that explains a lot of it. But that's a constant. That's not something that's changing over time, right?
But teenagers are finding out about the world for the first time. They're at school with a new social group and such that they've got to accommodate to. They've got to match in some way. They've got to fit in somewhere or another. They're under huge stress.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they're not that interested that we might expect them or hope them to be.
They're more preoccupied with the social aspects of
exactly.
growing up.
And of course, we've pointed out many times that there is an anti-intellectual, sort of anti-authoritarian counterculture in the United States, and that may be very intense in the younger age groups. That's particularly why we and other members of the skeptical movement are interested in making critical thinking and science cool, and hip. And basically, are you jiggy with that? But you know what I'm talking about, that we want to make people say, it's actually acceptable and cool to be smart and to like science and to be passionate about that. And I think the audience is filled with people who get it, and we just need more people to get it. Couple more.
Hi. I'd like to know, with regards to why some beliefs are persistent and we have trouble with them while others go away. And for example, like homeopathy was a really stupid idea that came out around 1800, and people still take it seriously, and we're still fighting it. Around the same time, an idea called phrenology came out, and we really don't have to go out there and tell people, no, you don't need to go to a doctor who will feel your head and tell you that. And, you know, we also don't have people who are into alchemy and think that they could use goat's blood to turn lead into gold or something. And so, well, not a whole lot of them, at least. Why is it that some of these ideas seem to persist and we go after them and nobody realizes how dumb they are, and others just kind of fade away and people say, okay, yeah, bumps on your head relating to health and personality, that's stupid, we're not going to deal with that. But
well, one element in there is the media. And the media will go after a thing like homeopathy because it's medical, apparently, and it cures people, it helps people, and they want to make a case out of it. And then they get a hold of somebody like me, a curmudgeon, a professional curmudgeon of long experience, and they make me look like a fool if they possibly can. Difficult to do, but they do it. And I think that the media is largely to blame for this. Yeah. The media doesn't care about phrenology any longer. If phrenology had just developed recently, maybe they would. But phrenology is sort of in the past.
Yeah, but my hypothesis is, in terms of why do we still have homeopathy and not phrenology, although there are still phrenologists out there, but they are very, very small in number, is that it's just purely historical cultural contingency. It's because phrenology was promoted by neurologists within mainstream medicine. And when the science moved past it and showed that the premises of phrenology were incorrect, then it faded away. How come we don't do bloodletting anymore? Well, it's because bloodletting and the humoral theory of medicine was popular among Western medicine, which then became scientific, and they got rid of it themselves. But homeopathy stood outside of science-based medicine or scientific medicine, became a self-sustaining, you know, immune to evidence and science belief system, and so it persists. So I think there's really nothing fundamentally different between phrenology and, say, chiropractic and homeopathy and acupuncture, except for their cultural history. I think that's the only real difference.
Steve, do you think it's possible, though, that there is an appeal that homeopathy and chiropractic have that maybe the others don't? Like, to me, they seem to have to kind of hit that chord, that magic chord, where there's a vibe about them. You know, they just have a feel
about
it.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, and that's why I said this is a hypothesis of mine, because you can't, I don't know of any evidence to separate out the selective, the Darwinian kind of selection of the most successful belief systems surviving and the ones that don't appeal as much or maybe don't make as much money for their practitioners or whatever it is. They're not as adaptive, so they don't survive as well. So we actually may be seeing the evolution of these belief systems as the more ones that are more effectively spread, that persist, that are profitable, are the ones that persist. Mm-hmm. But from the examples that I gave, I don't know that I can tell you what's really different between acupuncture and bloodletting, or, in fact, there may not really be any difference at all, or between phrenology and homeopathy, except for their history. That's the only difference that I can think of.
And the one big advantage that homeopathy has to the public is that it's perfectly safe. It's water. Yes, it can't really hurt you, because everyone drinks water, you see, even in the form of wine, for example, which is the way I prefer to ingest it. But nonetheless, it is perfectly safe, and it's also approved by various medical organizations, but the approval is limited to the fact that it won't hurt you.
Well, Jay, you're going to finish off with a quote for us.
This is a quote from William W. Channing. Every mind was made for growth, for knowledge, and its nature is sinned against when it is drowned in ignorance. William Channing!
Thank you, everyone, for joining us at Nexus 2010. And I want to say thank you to Michael, Matt, Paige, and Benny, the guys from the New York City Skeptics who did most of the heavy lifting to put this conference together. They did a great job. Thank you, guys.
Hallelujah. Steve Novella and the Skeptics Guide to the Universe.
And thank you, Jamie.
With special guest James Randi.
Touch your luck. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.